Radio.
Should bakers be forced to bake cakes for same-sex weddings? A lecture by Archbishop Anthony Fisher at the Center for Independence Studies annual Acton Lecture.
The year is 2025. 9 years after a plebiscite narrowly approved same-sex marriage, and Parliament amended the Marriage Act and many other laws to remove all references to a man and a woman, husband and wife, and mother and father. After an initial flurry of rather colourful same-sex weddings, numbers have now plateaued to only a few hundred each year. Sociologists debate the long-term effects on public understandings of marriage and family. Certainly, there have been political ramifications. No major party allows dissenters on this issue any longer. This caused some significant hemorrhaging from Parliament before the 2019 election. Even for most independents, going against the tide of history on this matter is regarded as disadvantageous. While provisions in the Marriage Equality Amendment Act, exempting registered ministers of religion and registered places of worship from taking part in gay weddings, have continued to stand in law, the High Court has ruled that Section 116 of the Constitution does not protect faith-based schools from having to teach a gay-friendly, state-imposed curriculum. Continuing to teach that marriage is an opposite-sex union was held by a majority of the justices to be motivated by outmoded and bigoted attitudes and to be harmful to children. Already, one Catholic bishop has been briefly jailed for refusing to apply the state-approved LGBTIQQ safety protocols and awareness program to the schools of his diocese. And parents at Jewish and Muslim schools have been advised that they may not withdraw their children from such programs. Many clergy and teachers in faith-based schools have been cowed with threats of prosecution for hate speech if they teach that divine law limits marriage to people of opposite sex. There are also actions pending against evangelical Christian and Maronite Catholic business owners for failing to provide photography, stretch limousine, and hospitality services for gay weddings. Greens and others have used this issue to chip away at the remaining exemptions and benefits enjoyed by churches and faith-based schools, hospitals, and welfare agencies. Government schools in most states no longer allow scripture classes, and church-based adoption services were forced to close. Religious organisations are now required to extend spousal benefits to same-sex married employees, have lost their charitable status, and now pay the same taxes and rates levied on any other business. By 2025, public speeches and debates on same-sex marriage and the like are rare, as few organisations and venues are willing to risk the vilification that follows upon hosting them. The idea that marriage is a natural institution that precedes states and religions, that is founded on sexual complementarity and oriented to family formation, is now regarded as unspeakable in the public square. Though from time to time, the usual suspects still raise it in their extreme right-wing think tanks, newspaper columns, or pulpits. Will all this come to pass in the decade ahead? And if so, what does it say about the quality of our democracy right now? And about our nation's particular take on secularity and religious freedom? Many years ago, when I was still a young priest and academic, the commentator B.A. Santa Maria asked me how it was that I was so optimistic about our culture. I responded that it was probably partly temperamental, partly my reading of the trends, and partly a matter of theological hope. He responded that he was not as naturally sunny in temper as I was, that he read the trends in our civilization more pessimistically, and that Christian faith only promises things will turn out for the best in the end. In the meantime, things could get very bleak indeed. In my paper tonight, I will turn first to the political theology of Pope Francis, asking, is the Pope a watermelon? And what is it he expects of democracies? In part two of my paper, I will use that theology as a prism through which to examine the state of democracy in contemporary Australia. Finally, in part three, I'll ask how we might preserve a space for religious liberty in this land. Part one. In his encyclical, Laudato Si, on the care of our common home, and a number of very recent speeches in the United States, Pope Francis has articulated the idea of an integral ecologism, that is, pro-God, pro-creation, and pro-people, and what this might mean for politics as well as personal life, including respect for religious liberty. For touching on matters such as anthropogenic climate change and other ill effects of our technocratic consumerist culture, the Pope has been characterised by some as a watermelon, green outside and red within. Yet no usual member of the watermelon commentariat would be so forthright in insisting that human beings are not pollution, their population growth not the problem, that we must respect our natures as male and female and the implications for self-image, relationships and institutions such as marriage, that the little ones most at risk are not merely the economically poor, but the unborn and the spiritually poor, and that we must seek not merely political or financial solutions, but moral and spiritual ones, and not expect governments to fix everything for us. In some ways, Pope Francis's call to asceticism and his attention to the local and personal are very traditional. Much of what he says about ecology rebrands things long said under other labels such as the natural and supernatural economies, or under titles like avarice, sobriety, temperance, fasting, and conversion. Of course, there is a particular Franciscan attention to the limits properly imposed upon our ambitions by our natural environment and the needs of the poor. But where the papacy long resisted the democratising impulses of the age, Francis, like his recent predecessors, seems to presume the moral superiority of democracies over other experiments in government, and to be asking more of them. What is that more? One thing is breadth of vision. The starting point for Laudato Si is that human life is grounded in the three fundamental and closely intertwined relationships with God, with our neighbour, and with the earth itself. Our natural and social ecologies are profoundly interconnected. True reverence for one, for example, for forests or seals, must complement reverence for the other, for example, fellow citizens, refugees, the unborn. Neglect or misuse of one often overflows to the other. And all these interrelate in complex ways with our sense of transcendent value, of the supernatural ecology. What is required, he thinks, is awareness of these interconnections, an ability to look beyond the immediate and comfortable, and a willingness to take courageous and far-sighted action. Though widely acclaimed for his positive and non-judgmental manner, Francis can be a sharp critic and readily names failures of contemporary democracies to to address some natural and social challenges. All too often, he suggests, our leaders seem driven by the desire for short-term success and to be ready to appease various interests or their electorate with bread and circuses. Such approaches lead not only to bad policy, but also to disengagement by ordinary people from politics. Continuing in this way, he warns apocalyptically, will make electorates cynical, hurt especially the poor, and leave future generations only debris, desolation, and filth. True statecraft, he insists, is principled statecraft. Even in difficult times, it respects rights, pursues the common good, and enables intermediate groups such as churches and families to play their essential subsidiary role. In the shadow of this encyclical, Francis recently took the challenge of true statecraft to a joint session of Congress. High-sounding visions and principles are not enough, he insisted. Statecraft is a practical art. It is intended to achieve things. You are asked to protect, by means of the law, the image and likeness fashioned by God on every human face, he said. Thus, a good political leader is one who, with the interests of all in mind, seizes the moment in a spirit of openness and pragmatism, initiating improvements for others rather than merely protecting his or her own interests, restoring hope, righting wrongs, maintaining commitments, and thus promoting the well-being of individuals and peoples. Francis further developed this call to a principled and practical statesmanship when he addressed the General Assembly of the United Nations. Politics must be people-centred, he insisted. The economic and social exclusion of some by those lucky enough to possess much denies fraternity, offends against human rights, and is irreverent toward creation and creator. Constantly aware of the real people who stand above and beyond all plans and programs, government leaders must, quote him, do all they can to ensure people have the spiritual and material means necessary to live in dignity and support a family. This minimum includes not only food, housing, and work, but also religious liberty and access to education, culture, and the natural environment. A right relationship to our common home is premised upon a sense of universal fraternity and deep respect for the sacredness of every human person. Without such commitments, even great democracies will fail to deliver what human beings most need. Pope Francis next addressed these matters at the place where the Declaration of Independence was signed. I was there to hear him read from the lectern used by Lincoln for his Gettysburg Address. Citing that declaration and that great president, he highlighted that the dignity and equality of every human being endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, which governments exist not to invent, but to protect. Each generation must reappropriate, rearticulate, and reenact those foundational values if democracy is to remain true to itself and achieve its high purposes. In that speech, as in many other places, Pope Francis identified respect for the democratic ideal of religious liberty as an essential precondition of peaceful coexistence, of an enriching pluralism, and of friendship and collaboration between people of different spiritual traditions. Democracies ignore religions at their peril. Religious communities play a crucial role in reminding democracies of the transcendent dimension of human existence and our irreducible freedom in the face of any claim to absolute power. Precisely because it reminds us that there is more to creation than ourselves, that we are creatures and not gods. Religious faith well lived provides the wherewithal to resist mandated orthodoxies and totalizing ideologies. If religion is to continue making this contribution to democratic societies, it must not be reduced, the Pope says, to a subculture without the right to a voice in the public square. The right to worship God individually and as a community, as conscience dictates, is certainly part of what religious freedom means. But religious liberty, by its nature, transcends places of worship and the private sphere of individuals and families, and must be respected and valued in the public square as well. Reiterating what he has said on many occasions, the Holy Father recognised that this is the age of martyrs. The religious liberty of Christians and other minorities is now openly attacked in places such as Syria, Iraq, Nigeria, and North Korea. But it can also be compromised in contemporary democracies. Driving religion from the public square and hollowing it out from the inside by reducing it to rituals and private beliefs undermines democratic foundations. If democracies are to do great things, they must maintain and renew their founding ideals. Following his predecessors, Pope Francis has set the bar high for democracy, emphasising in particular a visionary, principled and practical statesmanship that reverences God and people, especially the weak. How, by these standards, are we faring in Australia? Part 2. Coup capital of the democratic world. So Canberra was recently labelled by the BBC. Commentators have compared Australian government in the post-Hawke Keating Howard period with a Tarantino film and dubbed leadership spills our national sport. Without commenting on the quality of our prime ministers, 6 in 8 years, 4 in only 27 months, changed mostly by representatives rather than electors, is extraordinary. Several commentators think our revolving door leadership is a sign of malaise in our democratic ideals and practice. They have noted apathy, distrust, even cynicism amongst ordinary people about politics and politicians' antics. Complacency, intellectual torpor, and other diminishment in debate and policy making. Decline in cabinet process and teamwork, including internecine leaking that makes confident leadership and confidential discussion impossible. Blindly adversarial and obstructionist postures by government opposition and minority parties that paralyse governments to affect the policies for which they are elected. Governments that appeal to the basest fears rather than the noblest aspirations of their electorates, for example, over refugee policy. Electorates that punish their leaders who embrace sound policies that come with some short-term pain, for example, higher taxes or reduced benefits. Over-responsiveness of representatives and commentators to opinion polls, the 24/7 news cycle and spin. And a ruthlessly anti-authoritarian media culture that discourages quality candidates from offering themselves for political service. This year marks the 800th anniversary of that Magna Carta, which King John signed in the hope of buying collaboration from his rebellious barons. And the barons signed in the hope of limiting state power with principles against arbitrary imprisonment, fines and the like. The Charter is an important marker in the evolution of those ideals, dispositions and traditions of practice that underpin our version of democracy. Here we meet the first stirrings of the notion that good government requires the consent of the governed. As Lord Acton observed, following not Lincoln but Thomas Aquinas, legislation ought to be for the people and by the people. Yet respect for the general will is not enough to ensure good government. So the Charter began to articulate the principles grounding various checks upon the evanescent will of electors and elected, which have evolved since, such as constitutions, upper houses, cabinets and committees, the public service, the courts of law, natural justice, parliamentary conventions and protocols. Such principles are in need of re-articulation today. For as Lord Acton observed, a democracy is far to be preferred to tyrannies. The one pervading evil of democracy is that the majority, or rather that party that succeeds, can be tyrannical also. Magna Carta is, in fact, a rather religious document. Its self-described purpose is to honour God, exalt Holy Church, and better order the kingdom. In it, King John acknowledges that he rules under God, and that the rights and responsibilities recognised in the Charter are God-given rather than his inventions. To fail to recognise them would, the document claims, imperil the king's soul. The Constitution of Australia, though more modern, reflects the fact that our particular take on democracy, like that of Britain and the United States, is hugely influenced by our Judeo-Christian heritage. It records that the decision to unite in one indissoluble federal commonwealth under the Crown relied upon three things: the consent of the people of the several states, the sovereign power of the King in Parliament, and, thirdly, the blessing of Almighty God. Some would dismiss all this constitutional God talk, along with prayer in Parliament, as mere flourish to add gravitas, or heirlooms of a bygone age. Australia, they might say, ain't that way anymore. In next year's census, the no religion option were placed at the top of the religion-identifying question for the first time, as if it were now the default position in Australia. Pundits expect a leap in the number identifying as none from the 20% who did so in 2011 and a consequential decline in the 60% who identified then as Christian. There are other signs of fading religiosity in Australia. And many people seem happy to identify as Christian, live as practical agnostics, but draw upon the inherited social spiritual capital of religious beliefs and practices, even as ideological elites seek to reduce that influence in law and culture. John Emmerich Edward Dalberg Acton, the Lord Acton for whom our lecture is named, joined Edmund Burke, Alexis de Tocqueville, G.K. Chesterton and others in viewing the state as a partnership between the living, the dead, and those yet to come, between science, art, virtue, and religion, always working to improve the lot of the members. Though none of these was a fan of theocracy or ideology, they were equally wary of a democracy without respect for tradition and without a vision beyond the present. Just as a series of US Supreme Court decisions has abandoned their ancestors' views on faith and law, life and love, so political elites and opinion makers in Australia commonly press us in a more secularist direction. In 1992, the American court famously shunned all religious, customary or objectivist accounts of early human life and morality, declaring in Planned Parenthood v. Casey that at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe and of the mystery of human life. This year, the court did the same for marriage. As Chief Justice Roberts said, dissenting, in Obergefell v. Hodges, today the court invalidates the marriage laws of more than half the states and orders the transformation of a social institution that has formed the basis of human society for millennia. For the Kalahari Bushmen and the Han Chinese, the Carthaginians and the Aztecs. Just who do we think we are? Much might be said about post-modernity's denial of meta-narratives and thick conceptions of the good. But let me mention just one effect I think worthy of consideration tonight. It's often observed that for all the government's intergenerational reports, ours is the least fertile generation in history. And that for all the rhetoric about infrastructure, our generation is the least likely to construct any. I believe our failure to add much to the stock of rail, water, sewerage, and other infrastructure inherited from our ancestors, and our failure even to replace ourselves in population terms, are connected. Projects of the scale of the Snowy Mountains scheme required leaders and participants who cared deeply about the future. They knew it would be their descendants, not themselves, who would benefit. But our democracy today lacks transcendent vision, not just in the sense of a vision of the sacred, but also of hope for the future. A vision of a future for our descendants and of an eternity in which unnoticed good will yet be rewarded. As children and grandchildren loom smaller in the public consciousness, we are less likely to sacrifice for their sake in politics or elsewhere. Whether agnostic liberalism or a more watermelon-hued political correctness can provide our democracy the transcendent authority and horizon beyond self-interest it needs is yet to be demonstrated. 8 centuries ago, rights talk was less fashionable than it is today. Yet already people were aware of duties owed and grievances sustained. The first right recognised in the Magna Carta was religious liberty. The Ecclesia Anglicana was to be free to order her affairs and enjoy her liberties unimpaired. We are heirs to the idea that religion, in the very broad sense of speculation about the higher order of things or the ultimate ground of reality, and consequent honour of that or worship of those beyond the here and now, is a universal good. People should in general be free to seek and believe what they will religiously, and given a wide latitude to worship and live according to their conscientious beliefs. This is not a case of making exceptions for benighted eccentrics, but a recognition of something essential to human flourishing and enriching for the community. So the right to the free exercise of religion is recognised in multiple international treaties. I won't rehearse tonight my case for marriage as traditionally understood, or for retaining that understanding of marriage in our laws, which I've offered on many occasions. Tonight I'd like to reflect instead upon the conduct of the public debate on this issue so far, and what this reveals about the state of our democracy. When people like me, and some of you, enter the fray on marriage, we now expect to be tagged ultra-conservative, tedious imbecile, delusional nutter, evangelical claptrapper, and even nauseating piece of filth. Not just in the anti-social media, but even in the mainstream. What is new is that such ad hominem hails not just from fevered activists and net trolls, but from respected journalists and public figures. The ABC's Q&A program intrudes the same sex issue, whatever the published topic of the evening, every time. But even when a whole episode is devoted to debating the question, it's very clear only one view will be given serious attention. A number of commentators have noted the biased reporting on the same-sex marriage issue in many media outlets, and the refusal of some to allow even paid advertisements for the other side. When the ABC's Media Watch said it was time to give both sides a hearing, it was roundly scolded on the basis that hate has no rights, and that it is false balance to give the pro-traditional marriage side any attention at all. Closed-mindedness is, of course, no monopoly of people engaging in the same-sex marriage debate. But I think the refusal to listen is presently mostly on one side. Those in favour of the traditional understanding of marriage know their opponents' slogans and arguments well. Tolerance and diversity, love is love, no to hate, hence marriage equality. But advocates of gay marriage seem to think no reasonable person could think other than as they do. That not only are they right on this issue, but that their opponents are irrational and operating out of blind traditionalism or more likely hatred. This is surely one of the strangest aspects of this debate so far. That the understanding of marriage found in pretty well every serious civilization, legal system, religion, and philosophy till recently. That marriage brings together a man and a woman as husband and wife to be father and mother of any children that follow from their marital union. That view is now incomprehensible, even unspeakable, for many of our intelligentsia, journalists, politicians, and even business leaders. As Brendan O'Neill observed, a chokingly conformist climate now prevails on this and many other issues in Australia, so that those who dare to disagree will be demonised, harassed, and marginalised rather than refuted. That the Catholic Archbishop in Tasmania has been taken to that state's anti-discrimination commission for distributing a joint bishop's pastoral letter on marriage is a sign of how far things have gone and are likely to go in the near future, if not resisted. Same-sex marriage proponent, Senator Penny Wong, has insisted that there is nothing to fear from marriage equality, that religious liberty will be unaffected, and that those who support traditional understandings of marriage are stubbornly clinging to discriminatory laws and only offer arguments that are increasingly irrational. Now, such claims of bigotry and irrationality are strange, given that Senator Wong herself was opposed to the redefinition of marriage until only very recently. In any case, international experience of redefining marriage belies Wong's optimism about religious liberty. In the joint pastoral letter of the Australian bishops, many examples were given of individuals and groups who have suffered financial, social or legal sanction for holding to traditional marriage in places that have legislated for same-sex marriage or same-sex civil unions. Since that pastoral was published, there have been many more cases. Ministers of religion and places of worship may receive niggardly exemptions in such regimes. But ordinary believers and their businesses are given no leeway. And even religious institutions such as schools, hospitals and welfare agencies are expected to toe the PC line. Some Australian civil liberties commentators fear that were same-sex marriage legalised here, the power of the state would be similarly mobilised against dissenters. In the Tasmanian case, the complainant seeks not only to have the Archbishop sanctioned, but also to have all church schools forced to promote LGBTI awareness, tolerance, and behaviour. In early 2013, lesbian couple Rachel Cryer and Laurel Bowman asked the Oregon bakery Sweet Cakes to bake a same-sex wedding cake for them. Although bakery owners Melissa and Aaron Klein had always served all comers, They believe that baking a distinctively same-sex wedding cake would be facilitating a same-sex wedding, and explain that this would violate their religious beliefs that marriage is the union of a man and a woman. Cryer and Bowman filed a complaint that they had suffered discrimination based on sexual orientation, and the government agency upheld that complaint. Meanwhile, the Baker couple faced vilification, boycotts of their business, violent protests and even death threats, and were forced to close their shop and work from home. They were then fined $135,000 and encouraged by the tribunal to receive behaviour modification therapy so that they could be rehabilitated. Even if it would not have been unethical for such bakers to assist a same-sex wedding in so remote a way, democracy degenerates into despotism when it licenses such vilification of people's conscientious beliefs. 3. Tom Holland opens his book about the world around the year 1000 AD with the fateful meeting between Pope Gregory VII and the Emperor Henry IV. In an age of caliphs and Viking raiders, knights and bishops jockeying for power, feudal vendettas and the rest, Western Europe emerged as a distinctive culture and expansionist power. At the heart of this, Holland argues, were the disappointment of millennial hopes and the settling of a new relationship between ecclesial and civil authority that gave Christendom its particular energy and focus. Now, there are many views of the proper relationship between church and state, between various faiths and their agencies and civil government and its departments. Secularism, laïcité, or the separation of church and state, has many forms. What was essentially a millennial Christian contribution to our civilization, reflected also in the Great Charter, has mutated in various ways and places. In Western Europe today, as in the communist East of old, the tendency is to say that between church and state, ne'er the twain shall meet. Governments and courts increasingly exclude faith-based organisations from decision-making and service delivery. Dogmatic secularists ban Christian Christmas decorations from public places, church bells from towers, crucifixes from schools or nurses' necks, and any residual religious values in law and policy. Some want believers to renounce their most deeply held beliefs or stay silent about them in the public square. Religion is thought to be so inherently backward, even dangerous, that the tag believer, let alone ultra-Catholic, disqualifies one from civil leadership. If there are countries in which state or culture-imposed atheism is dominant, there are others in which religious leaders dictate terms to government and society, including to those who do not share their faith. In the nightmare of the Arab Spring turned jihadi winter, extremists seek to impose the only pure version of the only approved faith, even on their co-religionists. While on Tom Holland's view, it was Christendom that first distinguished the spheres of God and Caesar, Pope and Emperor, the great advantage of the development of the West. We know it suited many Christian leaders through those centuries to blur those lines. The same is so for some believers today. And there are still conceptions of church and state that recognise no such line even to be blurred. In theocracies, as in secular tyrannies, either religion is in charge of everything or secular politics is, but no compromise between the two is possible. As if supportive of this no compromise view, the United States seems to have the two extremes at once. With lots of public religious rhetoric as if being religious is expected, even of presidents, and various bans on public religion, as if irreligion is compulsory. Bakers are fined and marriage registrars jailed for refusing to go along with same-sex marriage, as if this were a dogma of the state religion. Richard John Newhouse famously thought that an iron curtain or wall of separation had been erected between church and state in America, such that the nation's foundational ideals and people's deepest convictions are now regularly ruled out of court, out of bounds. This leaves the public square so naked that Americans are unable to engage in the properly political task of determining how to live together. Here in Australia, we distinguish between the spheres of activity proper to church and state, each with its proper inspiration and responsibilities, instrumentalities and methods. Rather better, in my view, than in Europe or America or the rest. Church and state in this country mostly leave each other well enough alone. So far, no bakers have been required to put two brides atop their cakes. Where the spheres of church and state do overlap, Australians have been inclined to a healthy, pragmatic cooperation for the public benefit, rather than iron curtains or trench warfare. So we've had fruitful collaborations between church and state in law and policy, in provision of education, health and aged care, and various welfare services, in special religious education in government schools, in chaplaincy to state institutions, in things like the state funeral that I will have in my cathedral on Saturday. The biggest religious gathering, youth gathering, gathering of any sort in the history of this country, World Youth Day 2008, was an example of this. Every sector of our community cooperated in the planning and delivery, not Catholics or Christians only, or the private non-profit sector only, but practically everyone. That said something powerful, which our visitors commented on. The church and state, people of various religions and none, can live and let live, give each other a fair go, honour diversity, seek common ground, and work together in this country. But wherever religious liberty is at risk, such coexistence and collaboration are also threatened. A member of the US Equal Opportunity Commission recently said that, sympathetic as she is to religious freedom, there's a zero-sum gain with respect to religious freedom and LGBT rights. Instead of attempting to balance such competing liberties, society must opt for LGBT rights over religion every time. Several justices in Obergefell acknowledged that that would be an inevitable effect of the decision they had made to legalise same-sex marriage. Yet true democracy is a political order that acknowledges deeply held moral and religious convictions are important, permits differences in these matters, and as far as reasonable, allows expression of those differences in action and inaction on conscientious ground. The democratic state concedes that people must obey both God and Caesar. That is why the various human rights instruments and their underpinning political philosophies acknowledge the right to hold different religious and moral convictions as a non-derogable right, and also rights to express those convictions in public and not be compelled to act against them, to be protected in this by the state and not denied it by powerful ideological, financial, or majority political interests. Not that all claims of conscience will always be trumps. As the centrality of the human person and the common good grounds respect for conscience, it also requires that practices like child sacrifice be forbidden. Beyond such extremes, considerable latitude is possible. But in postmodernity, having principles, internally consistent and braced with passion over a long period, is not only less common, but can seem unimaginative even fanatical. The desire to get along may mean we give each other space to do our own thing. But we're left suspicious of what the other person's thing might be, and sceptical that there is any truth in matters of life and love and the rest. As conscience reduces to personal taste, respect for its claims is harder to sustain. Thus, while totalitarian secularists will concede some pleas of conscience to oddballs, they aim to rid law and policy of any whiff of incense and are inclined to view conscience claims as marginal, even antisocial. Beyond a narrow field of worship, they would similarly reduce the scope of religious liberty. To conclude, the year is 2025, 9 years after the plebiscite to redefine marriage was defeated, partly because most Australians still treasured marriage as traditionally understood, partly because they thought government had no business regulating other friendships, partly because they were convinced a mature democracy does not rush into such important decisions, and partly because they feared marriage equality would make Australians less equal in matters of faith and conscience. Rather than taking the divisive turn proposed back in 2015, other signs of respect for people with same-sex attraction have been embraced by most Australians. Terms like man and wife and mother and father survive in law and practice, and new measures help support marriages and marriage-based families. A robust but courteous debate continues, but most agree the decade-long exercise of patience and respect in pursuit of a moral consensus in this area has demonstrated democratic maturity and strengthened, not diminished, our common life. In this 2025, faiths still play a major role in our community as providers of much human and supernatural support, of formation in crucial moral and political values, and as providers of charitable services in education, health, aged care, welfare and the like. Believers feel supported rather than threatened by the state in holding their high ideals. And there is healthy dialogue between people of different faiths and between believers and nuns. Australians are proud of their historic compact between church and state, freedom of conscience and rule of law. All the more so in a world where many countries take a less tolerant direction and whole populations have suffered persecution, exile or death as a result. Most agree we should resist totalising ideologies that would seriously upset that historical balance. Most want our bakers to be left to bake good cakes, unencumbered by such dogmatism. My more sanguine 2025 required people back in 2015 to embrace the mission of not only rebuilding the nation's physical infrastructure, but also renewing its spiritual capital so that it might be visionary, principled and practical, with the right reverence for God and people, to use Pope Francis II's inherited tests of democratic health. Having and following principles, internally consistent and embraced with passion, but also publicly contestable, is not only regarded as epistemically and psychologically defensible, but also as socially and politically essential. Forming people in such ideals and giving them confidence in their application was something to which the Church devoted much energy in the intervening decade. Teachers, scholars, lawmakers, commentators, and other thoughtful individuals have made important contributions to the renewal of our democracy. Liberty, as Lord Acton observed, is not the power of doing what we like, but the right to do what we ought. In the 20-teens and 2020s, we realised that only by renewing our social spiritual capital could we ask what that ought is that we should do with our liberty, and then be able to do it. Thank you.
That was Archbishop Anthony Fisher with Should Bakers Be Forced to Bake Cakes for Same-Sex Weddings? This lecture was hosted by the Center for Independent Studies and recorded by XT3. And for more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.